From the Triangle Radio Reading Service in Raleigh, North Carolina, this is Dick Hayden, and it's time to connect to success. On Connect to Success, we explore various ways through which one can pursue their own success by learning from others. We do this through interviews with and reading articles about people who are visually impaired and who have achieved success in their lives. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Connect to success. What does that mean? Well, connect is pretty straightforward. It is joining two or more things together. Success is broader, yet very personal. It can be as simple as completing a single task or as complex as accomplishing a multi-part long-term goal. It's all about hope, imagination, and resilience. It's being open to what is possible. And it's personal because it is what you decide is most important to you. During today's program, we will be speaking with Bob Kennedy of Durham, North Carolina, a man of many talents who would not let blindness get in his way to explore life in many, many ways. We will explore with him how he was able to connect with his personal definition of success. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you.
To begin with, would you be willing to share with our listeners the way in which you are visually impaired and how it came about?
I was born with glaucoma. I think there's less than 1% of us that have that dubious distinction. I was born with glaucoma, and at the age of 11, actually, I was playing in a backyard baseball game and got clobbered with the bat. And by the time I turned 12, everything but light was gone. Everything but light perception, I guess, was gone. And from the age of 12 on, it's just been, there's been no vision at all.
Wow. That was a baseball game you'll remember.
Lights out.
Hit you in the head?
Yes. I got hit in the head and the brain swelling from that, and plus the lack of knowledge about glaucoma back in the late 50s, early 60s was... The two combined was enough to kill everything.
Did you get any medical care after being hit with that bat?
I went to the hospital and they did x-rays and so on to make sure my head wasn't busted. But everything was scrambled around inside. It probably never has gotten straightened out. If you ask some people, they'll agree with that.
I don't believe that.
I thought for years I wanted to work for Central Intelligence, and I thought that meant putting your brains all in one place.
Well, it didn't affect your sense of humor, apparently. Yeah. How did this event affect you when you were, of course, given the age, I'd say in your teen years?
Well, the big thing that is different as a teenager when you can't see is you look forward to getting a car when you're 16. You want to be able to drive and this and that. And of course, that went right out the window. I had a tandem bicycle, for example. And I had a sighted friend that he and I drove all over the county with it, rode all over, pedaled all over, whatever you want to say. We did all our trafficking with the bike. And then, of course, when we turned 16, he got a motorcycle first. And I rode some with him, but, you know, since you can only have two people on a motorcycle and a girlfriend makes three as a crowd.
And so, four makes it hard to double date.
Yeah. So anyway, that was the big difference back then. I didn't know there was going to be so many roadblocks as far as people's thinking goes. I was just used to deciding I wanted to do something and going out and see if I could or not, but I wasn't used to somebody else saying it wouldn't work, whether they knew it would or not.
Did you run into that a lot?
I did, because I chose a career that most blind people don't choose. I was fascinated with engines, so I started out in the late 60s. I was only 14 when I started working on cars. I had a neighbor that was an automotive machinist, and so we kind of formed a business together where I would take the parts off the engine and then he would run them into the shop and do the machine work on them, and I'd put the car back together. And that's how I got my start in the automotive industry. Then I went into motorcycles, and then I went to motorcycle school, and then I went ran a marina for a while. So I if it had an engine, I wanted to know how it worked. So people would just that you'd go into interview in a dealership or a business, and they'd go, "Well, how do you keep your finger out of the fan?" You know, it's like, "Well, I know where the fan is, and I know enough to stay away from it." You know,
you learned that lesson early.
Yeah, you know, and of course he could tell you this person, that, and the other that have lost their fingertips. Well, that's just being stupid. You know, you don't stick your fingers in the fan because it'll take off those fingertips like you're talking about.
Did that desire to work with engines manifest during high school in terms of any particular courses that you took?
No, they wouldn't let me into the I was in the school for the blind in New York through 11th grade, and I never did a good job accepting blindness. So I knew I was always afraid if I graduated from the school for the blind that anything blind on your job application was going to mean you don't get an interview. So sports was my avenue, and I used that to get into a public high school. I didn't realize that the law said they can't keep you out of the public high school. They just wouldn't. They talk like I wasn't allowed in there. And so when I came over and worked out with the wrestling team on Christmas vacation, they were wondering why I was in a different school, and so that was how I got in. They went to bat for me instead of me.
Wrestling was your chosen sport?
Yeah, that was the one I was best at, yeah.
So you moved over to public high school then and finished up there and enjoyed the sports to go with it.
Yeah, I was offered a couple scholarships to universities to wrestle there, but I thought I was in love at 18, and so I turned them all down. I just figured going to college would be putting off so much of what I wanted to do, I was able to do already, and I didn't see the need for college education to work on an engine.
How did your parents react to all of this?
My dad liked the idea that I worked on cars because he didn't have to take his car to the shop any longer. But I remember when I was getting ready to leave New York, I had a job offer in Charlotte way back in the 80s, and I was going to move to Charlotte. And first thing to come out of my dad's mouth when I told him I got the job down there, he says, "Where am I going to take my car to get it fixed?"
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
it's like, congratulations, you got a job. Congratulations, you know, blah, 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 or whatever. It was where am I going to take my car to get it fixed now? Strangely enough, it took 3 years of him not having anybody fix the car, and he moved down to South Carolina 3 years later. So
I think he'd get closer to his mechanic.
Yeah, knew where to find me.
I would say that speaks well for your mechanical ability if you have a following.
I had a good one in Charlotte back in the 80s. I was doing automatic transmissions for Pontiac. I was working in a Pontiac dealership, and there was no shortage of evening work.
Really?
I could work in the dealership during the day, and then people would find out what your name is and where you lived and all. I was rebuilding transmissions at home for $200 labor in the dealership. The total price was getting up, of course, close to from $1,100 to $1,300, you know.
Wow.
So people were real interested in coming over and having you do it at home.
Well, how did you learn to deal with the transmissions? Like, I mean, they're fairly complex items. Same thing with the car engine, just trial and error, or did you have somebody kind of help you learn it?
You know, back when I was getting started on engines, yeah, I had my neighbor and I, we worked together at evenings, and he taught me how to take the engines apart and so on. And then as you're talking, as you take it apart, you're getting explained how it works. Then I got to doing more and more. Everything didn't have to be machined. You know, a fuel pump quits, there's no need to send it into a machine shop. You just pull the pump out and replace it. Or took some time learning how to rebuild a carburetor back then, because there's so many little bitty parts, little check balls, little fine springs and so on. That took a lot of learning where they go and how to put them back in there.
I'm sensing there might be a lot of muscle memory involved as you do it repetitively. As they say, you know, the soldier who who's told to learn how to take his rifle apart and put it back together, and then he has to do it blindfolded. And that's literally what you're doing with the transmissions and the engines. You do it enough times, you know where things go and by touch.
Yeah, you start to you make things that work for you, like GM cars had 10 check balls in the transmission. And if you put one in the wrong slot, it doesn't work.
So that's a pretty good obvious indicator.
There was a metal spacer plate that let the fluid go through, and there was an opening where the check ball was in that range. So I drilled them out to the size of the check ball and then labeled them. And that's how I put it back together. You just bolt the spacer plate on the body of the transmission and drop the balls in, and then you take the template off and put your gaskets on and the original spacer plate that doesn't have the holes drilled in it. And then when you bolt it all back up, everything's where it should be. And you have to buy a few things to make it work for you, but it's not that it can't work for you. You just have to find out how to make it work so it will work for what you need it to do.
Well, I've got a question for you. It might be a trick one. You said you worked at a Pontiac dealership.
Uh-huh.
And you just said about GM transmissions having the balls in them there.
Uh-huh.
All GM transmissions the same at the time?
Yeah.
There wasn't very... So you could have worked on Buicks or Cadillacs or Chevys?
Yep.
Now, how about those ones you did at home? Did you stay with the GM line or did you take anything?
Well, I did... I could do the Ford and Chrysler and GM. I could the fellow that owned the Pontiac dealership in Charlotte also owned a Dodge dealership, and he came in to see me one day. There was nobody doing transmissions at his Dodge dealership, and he asked me if I'd ever worked on one, and I said, well, I did a Caravan that they brought in here on a wrecker last week. And he says, how'd that turn out? And I said, well, they pulled it in and drove it out. Good. He says, I've got a truck coming to pick your tools up. And he says, you're going to start working over there.
Oh, boy. Well, there explains it.
It was a good switch for me, except for where I lived and where I worked. It just added 20 more minutes to the drive or the ride.
They should have brought the transmissions to you.
Yeah, they should have.
That would have worked out a lot better.
Got my own garage. You know.
Well, I think you're married.
I am.
So the blindness didn't stop you from doing that.
Nope, I'm married to a nurse. So,
really?
Yeah. So she's... Nurses have that helpful instinct about them.
Uh-huh. If you say that with a little chuckle. Is there something you do or don't want to expand on?
Yeah, I better leave it at that.
You want to leave it at that? Your wife might just tune in the show. Okay, well, let's leave it at that. I think you have somebody else who kind of provides you a little bit of assist. Somebody named Flyer.
Flyer's he's my fourth seeing-eye dog.
Yeah. He's in the studio with us right now, folks.
Yeah, he's takes up a big space in here. Flyer's about 115-pound German Shepherd.
Wow.
Stands almost 30 inches tall across the back.
That explains when I met him and he jumped up and put his paws on me. He was looking me straight in the eye.
Yeah, he can kiss me on the face, and I'm 6'3". So he doesn't get up on his back feet a lot, so he had a special connection with you when you came in.
Well, I like him. I like him.
As big as he is, he's the most gentle one I've had of the four. He's what I call an old man's dog. He's a stroller instead of a walker. You know, he likes that 2 to 3 mile an hour walk instead of that 4 to 5 where you feel like you're on a sprint across town. You know,
how old were you when you got your first assist dog?
My first dog was 1974.
1974.
75. I'm sorry.
They had dogs back then. In the old days?
Yeah, that's how we got around town.
Yeah.
Pulled the sled.
Now, wait a minute.
Yeah, I got my first dog in 75, January of 75. And
what kind was he?
They've all been shepherds.
All shepherds.
All males.
Uh-huh.
And all from Seeing Eye in New Jersey. I've got a sequential calendar going here. I got my first in January. The second was in February. The third was in March. And Flyer was in April. So
wow.
I won't live long enough to get to December. But
well, you never know.
I've been to New Jersey during January, February, and March, and those are not times I want to go back for. April was great weather, yeah. Cold and snow. I've lived around it enough. And
you were born in?
I was born in West Virginia.
Really?
Yeah.
Where?
Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Oh, I know Parkersburg, sure.
I do a lot of woodworking, and one of the stores I frequent here in Raleigh is Woodcraft, and that's where they are headquartered, is in Parkersburg.
How'd you get into woodworking?
Oh, boy. That, I call that my Braille art.
Braille art.
Yeah, you can take a piece of wood that's, let's hope it's flat.
Okay.
And it's just a plank of wood laying there. And, you know, as you turn it into something else, you can see the changes take place in it. You know, if I'm painting on a canvas, you have no idea what happened there. Is this blue paint? Is this red paint? Is it brown, green, whatever? And you're not going to do a very good job using your fingers to follow the paint around. But a piece of wood, as soon as I put a sculpt an edge on the side of it, or cut it and form it with something else, or turn it on the lathe, these are all things you can put your hands on and see the changes take place.
Speaking of hands, it looks to me like you've got all your fingers.
I do. Something I used to stress during job interviews when I was working in a garage, the guys would tell me, you know, well, I don't see how you could do this, and I don't think you'd be able to do that. And you'd always end up going, you never even asked to see how many fingers I have.
And they're all there.
Yeah, so, you know, you tell me about these people who stick their fingers in the fan, and you don't ask to see if I've done that.
Well, did you start woodworking while you were still growing up in West Virginia, or did that come afterwards?
I started, I got some introduction when I was in the School for the Blind in New York. I was in West Virginia with my grandparents until I lost my sight, and they just didn't feel like they were qualified to have me around at that. Once I lost my sight, they were like, they were older, and most images of blind people for them were the people that sat outside the department store selling pencils. So,
yeah, they had the historical view.
Yeah.
From way back.
Yep. And I go way back.
You're not that old. I can tell.
I'm 62 right now.
Oh, you Jeremy, your child. I'm 76.
There you go. So, yeah, that we were out in the country and had a farm, and everything in West Virginia is either up or down. There's very few flat spots, so
that's
they were
true.
Afraid I'd fall over the hill and into the creek, or, you know, walk into the barn with a snake or some silly thing. Out in the country, sitting still just wasn't very appealing. No one to talk to, no one to play with.
Not for a guy who liked motors.
Yeah, right. Yeah, let me work on this tractor. Get away from that.
So off to Buffalo, huh?
Yeah, I was a little north and east of Buffalo, a little town called Lockport.
So, automotives and woodworking. I'd like to hear more about your woodworking. What do you do with that these days?
I've gotten more into it since I bought a house to renovate.
Wait a minute. You are renovating a house?
Yeah. That
somebody's doing all the work for you, right?
No. I had somebody put a roof on the place for me. I could have done it, but, since I bought it in December, I'd probably been out there in August still doing it. I don't do painting. I leave that to my wife. I can do plumbing. I can do electrical. I can do drywall, build cabinets if I need to. The vanities in the house are handcrafted. I built the vanities. And I bought it because I enjoyed little remodel projects. I thought this would be really cool to buy a whole house and do it. And just, it's had everything you could want and more.
Sounds like a renovator's dream.
Oh, yeah. First week I moved in, I knew I was going to have to replace the water heater because it took forever to get hot water around the house and turned it up as high as it would go, and it just wouldn't warm up. I bought a water heater, moved it into the house. Friday morning, I was all set. I was going to go over and change that water heater out. I was so happy. I had this big box of plumbing fittings and tools and all. And I went trooping down the stairs into the basement. And I stepped off that last step and I was into an inch and a half of freezing cold water.
Oh, no.
And this was in January, and the water heater had rusted through on the side, and it was just spewing water out.
Well, where'd you pick up all these skills, though? I mean, I don't gather that you've gone to specific school to learn electricity,
exactly.
To learn plumbing. You didn't be a journeyman carpenter or apprentice and have your union card and everything?
I don't have a card for any of them.
You just do it?
The habit for blind people is to reach right out and touch something to see what's going on. And
so you're what we might call an experiential learner?
I tell you, years ago, in 96, the Olympics were in Atlanta. I was a member of the Paralympic judo team at that time. I'd come in second in the trials for the Olympics. So when I was down there, I was in the crowd and couldn't get on the other side of the ropes where the actual teams were. So people noticed me and they were bringing their program over for me to sign. I thought, who am I? I'm number two. Has a special ring to it. They were asking me to sign it, and that wasn't a problem. But one couple came up and they said, could you say something personal? And I said, I don't know you. So they said, say something personal about you. And I thought for a minute, and I started writing, never let others, and I underlined that, set your limitations. So I underlined others and your. Never let others set your limitations, which means don't ask somebody if you can do it. Find out for yourself. That's kind of been my theory as I've gone along here. I will ask somebody if I can do this or that or the other. If I can watch them do it, then I decide for myself. Is that something I feel like I can do? We have a little website out there called Woodworking in the Dark.
www.woodworkinginthedark.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are links on there to different things I've made, things I sell, furniture I make, so on like that. There's also links to videos for tools I review and so on. And we have a channel on YouTube called Woodworking in the Dark. We demonstrate some of the better tools out there for woodworking.
The inscription that you made for the person that you wrote, that sounds to me like your definition of success.
Success is so different to so many different people,
Absolutely. It's very personal.
Yeah. From the time I was 18 till I was 60, I had a job. One of the forms of discrimination as you get older that you can't prove, but you know it's out there, is why don't you just retire? I lost my job in February of 14, and all of a sudden, things just started coming back. You go back to what you used to do well. I've had tons of small engine repairs come in, lawnmowers, chainsaws, tractors, things like that. I used to have a shop for that, and so here I am doing it out of my house again, building furniture and selling it that people connect with you off your website. I've sold tables. And I make segmented bowls that people like. They're three different color bowls. So people are wanting to buy things like that. I don't make quite as much as I used to, but I don't have near the headaches that I used to.
As I've listened to you and talked with you about your journey, it seems that you have a lot to offer to two groups of people. One, folks who are in our age group who run into situations where they have a choice to either stop doing or continue doing, but maybe not doing exactly what they were doing, but keeping at. And also something for our younger listeners who are trying to figure out their life, what they're going to do, coming to grips with their situation, and feeling perhaps at times like it's just too difficult. But you seem to have proven that success is going to be whatever you want to make it be.
I used to do some public speaking, and one of the topics we used to get on was the hallway of no. And that's, how bad do you want something? You start down this hallway, and it's, I want to be a woodworker. You knock on the first door, and say, yeah, there's no use for you getting into woodworking. You cut your fingers off. That's a no. So we go to the next door, and it's, you don't need to be doing woodworking because blind people don't do woodworking. There's another no. And you just have to keep knocking on a door until you find one that says, whoa, why don't you try it and see if you like it? You just keep going down the hallway. Eventually, if you stop at the first door and they say no, then you turn around, you don't know what you've given up. You can't do that. Well, I guess they know. They can see and I can't, and they're going to tell me blind people can't do this or that. I used to be afraid of hearing somebody say no because I knew I was going to have to put so much time and effort into proving them wrong.
I don't think you take no easily.
I don't do well with no. I used to tell people I don't color inside the lines very well at all, and that's true. In the automotive industry, I worked for Pontiac and Dodge were the two big names. I worked a couple different dealerships that sold other cars. The folks at Pontiac and Dodge knew who I was. And it was very interesting because in Charlotte, I could go to a dealership and apply for a job doing automatic transmissions, and they knew who I was. In the late 80s, I was still in the dealership in Charlotte and went to the training school at the GM Training Center, and I went to the bathroom, and I came back and turned into the wrong class, and there was a room full of engineers in there discussing things. They were talking about how many computers they were going to be putting on these newer cars, and I thought, yeah, this is an area of interest for me. And it wasn't a class, it was just like a brainstorming in there. So I walked up and I said, how many computers are you expecting to see in the future? And The one guy told me that it was up to 6 or 8 of them could be on the car soon. And I thought, that's it. There's my red flag that I'm seeing.
Yeah.
I'm the only blind guy in the country wanting a scan tool that will talk. And you can't do the job without the scan tool. And there's no market for them. So they're not going to be in any hurry to make one talk. They still haven't done it. So that was my warning flag to start planning on getting out. And I went to college when I was 36 and graduated when I was 40, and from there I've gone to different places. A friend and I ran a newspaper. Didn't make a lot of money, but we had a bunch of fun. Then I went to work for Wells Fargo, the mortgage people, and I worked for Sears for a while. And so I've been around some major companies, and that, you know, that's what I considered success, was being a hell of a job, fed the family.
And looked at new things. Sounds like it's never say no. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Connect to Success. And our thanks to Bob Kennedy. Bob, we appreciate your sharing your thoughts and your experiences with our listeners. We hope that you have enjoyed today's program and found something in it that can be beneficial to you or someone you know. It's never too soon or too late to connect to your success. Be sure to tune in the third Tuesday of the month at 2:30 p.m. This program is rebroadcast as noted in the TRRS program guide and is available as a podcast at our website, www.triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call TRRS at 919-832-5138. I'm Dick Hayden for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time. We'll be right back.